Lecture 8, Business with God, The Life of John Calvin. We're not our own. Let not our reason nor our will therefore sway our plans and deeds. We're not our own. Let us not therefore set it as our goal to do what is expedient for us according to the flesh. We're not our own. Insofar as we can, let us forget ourselves, therefore, and all that is ours. Conversely, we're God's. Let us therefore live for Him and die for Him. We're God's. Let His wisdom and will therefore rule all our actions. We're God's. Let all the parts of our life accordingly strive toward Him as our only lawful goal. Young Frenchman was a lawyer, just 30 years old, wrote those words in 1539. He had just recently been converted to the Protestant faith, and he now lived in the city of Strasbourg. His name, of course, was John Calvin. And as we study the life of Calvin today, let's remember those words from Calvin. We are not our own. We are God's. We'll begin with a prayer from Calvin. Calvin wrote many prayers, and the one that I have chosen to use today is Calvin's prayer for the morning, prayer that he wrote for his people to use in their times of prayer in the morning. Let's join together in this prayer from Calvin. As I read these words, let's pray in our hearts. My God, my Father and Preserver, who of Thy goodness hast watched over me during the past night and brought me to this day, grant also that I may spend it wholly in the worship and service of Thy most holy Deity. Let me not think or say or do a single thing which tends not to Thy service and submission to Thy will, that thus all my actions may aim at Thy glory and the salvation of my brethren, while they are taught by my example to serve Thee. And as Thou art giving light to this world for the purposes of external life by the rays of the sun, so enlighten my mind by the effulgences of Thy Spirit, that He may guide me in the way of Thy righteousness. To whatever purpose I apply my mind, may the end which I ever propose to myself be Thy honor and service. May I expect all happiness from Thy grace and goodness only. Let me not attempt anything whatever that is not pleasing to Thee. Do Thou add more and more to the gifts of Thy grace until I wholly adhere to Thy Son, Jesus Christ, whom we justly regard as the true Son shining constantly in our minds. In order to my obtaining of Thee these great and manifold blessings, forget, and out of Thy infinite mercy, forgive my offenses, as Thou hast promised that Thou wilt do to those who call upon Thee in sincerity. Amen. We'll look at Calvin's life today, and I will say some things about the life of this remarkable man, and then the next lecture we will focus particularly on Calvin's theology. As a boy and a young man, Calvin's life was largely controlled by his father. His father was a very ambitious assistant to the Bishop of Noyon. Calvin's grandfather had been a boatman on the river near that French town, and Calvin spoke of himself as from the common people. But Calvin's father was very ambitious, particularly for this son who had apparently from early years great intellectual gifts, and Calvin arranged for Calvin's father arranged for Calvin to be tutored in a local family with the sons of that family, a very aristocratic family, and Calvin then received his early education in the context of that family. That probably explains something of Calvin's very aristocratic manner and a rather elegant bearing as he lived and studied in that Montemore family in Noyon. Soon he was sent to the University of Paris, to the Sorbonne, where he studied, graduating with a degree in the arts. But Calvin's father, thinking that Calvin would become a priest and hoping that perhaps he would rise very high in the Catholic Church, Calvin's father began to change his mind and suggested that Calvin now go and study law. Calvin tells us that his father discovered that lawyers made more money than priests and thought it would be a good idea for Calvin to follow that career, and very obediently, without much enthusiasm, but obediently, Calvin went into law, studying at two of the finest law schools in Orléans and in Bourges. And then began to cast about to know what he was going to do in life. Actually, he did not want to be a priest, and he didn't want to be a lawyer either. But young John Calvin, very dapper-looking young man in this picture, really wanted to be a scholar and write books and have people read them. He set out to make a name for himself in the world of scholarship, and at this time in his life, he is really very much controlled by his own ambition. He published a commentary on an old Roman Stoic philosopher whose name was Seneca. Seneca had written a book called On Mercy, and even though Erasmus had written on Seneca, Calvin did not hesitate to write on Seneca too. And his book came out in 1532. Not many people read it, apparently, and Calvin did not receive the fame that he had hoped that he would receive by writing this book. But something very important happened to Calvin about this time. He tells us in the preface to the Psalms commentary, which he wrote many years later, something about this experience. That, by the way, is one of the few times that Calvin writes much about himself. Luther wrote a good bit about himself and talked about himself, and we can get really into the heart of Luther much more easily than we can with Calvin, because Calvin was very reluctant to speak very much about himself. But in writing his commentary on the Psalms, in the preface to that, he did give something of his story, his testimony, and because he doesn't do that very often, those words are very important. And Calvin says that as he was going along, ambitious and determined to make a mark for himself in the world, God turned my course in another direction. What happened was that by an unexpected, or perhaps the word should be translated, sudden conversion, he tamed to teachableness a heart too stubborn for its years. Well, that's Calvin's way of saying that he was converted and brought into God's family. When did that happen? We really don't know exactly. Scholars have tried to determine the year, and the dates tend to range from 1532 to 1534. When he wrote the Seneca commentary, there's no evidence that he is a Protestant Christian. Perhaps you would not expect to find it there, but you might find it there, but there's no evidence that Calvin has come to this time of conversion that he talks about in the Psalms commentary. 1534, he resigned his ecclesiastical benefices money that he was receiving from the Catholic Church that his father had arranged for him to pay for his education. Everybody was doing this. Calvin received the money from the church. He was supposed to be filling a particular office in the church, which he really didn't do. The father arranged for somebody else to do it at little cost. And the income then from this benefice, two benefices, went to Calvin to support him in his career. When you see a 16th century person give up money like that, it certainly meant that the person was no longer a Catholic. And Calvin, by this time, by 1534, was a Protestant. So he's in his mid-20s. 23, 24, 25 years old by the time that he's converted. The second question is who? Who led him to Christ? What was the influence that brought him into the Protestant faith? God, he says, turned my course. In his testimony, he doesn't mention anybody's name. Simply says God did it. We can almost be assured that Calvin had been reading Luther. In fact, in one of his writings, Calvin calls Luther my father in God. So Luther's impact on Calvin was very significant. And there were other evangelically minded French friends of Calvin. Perhaps he heard Protestant message from them. But we simply don't know the human instrument that God used to bring Calvin to faith. The question, what is there to enable me to comment just a moment on what really happened to Calvin? Well, the way Calvin says it is that God tamed to teachableness a mind too stubborn for its years. This was not a slow enlightenment. It was a sudden conversion, an unexpected conversion. Calvin really uses the illustration in the Psalms commentary that he was like a horse going down a road, and then God suddenly pulled on the reins and turned him around, and he found himself going somewhere else, controlled by someone else. Most people in the 16th century who became known in scholarship or even in ministry would adopt a motto. Luther did, and Calvin did too. Calvin's motto was a hand outstretched with a heart in the hand. Here is a modern, rather stylized use of Calvin's hand and the motto. Actually, the words that he wrote for his motto in Latin, in English, would read, "My heart I give you, O Lord, promptly and sincerely." Now, it's one thing, of course, to say that's my motto. It's another thing to live up to it. But some remarkable ways Calvin put this into practice. One of the best books on the life of John Calvin, which I mentioned in the section for further study, is Jean Cadier's book, The Man God Mastered. And as you read that book, you realize that in so many ways Calvin did do exactly what he set out to do, and that was to offer his heart to the Lord promptly and sincerely. The place of his ministry, Geneva. Twice he was in Geneva. The first time he ended up as servant of the Lord in the church in Geneva without really expecting to be there, and really without wanting to be there. It became unsafe for Calvin to stay in France. As he became more and more known as a Protestant leader, even though he was a very young man. It was dangerous for him to be in France, and especially after he had published his Institutes at Basel in 1536, and that book went out with Calvin's name on it, he was, you might say, a marked man. So he left France to go to Strasbourg. And what he wanted to do in Strasbourg was to have the life of a scholar. That was his bent. Calvin was the kind of person who really loved to spend all his time in his study. And he thought, I'll leave France and I'll go to Strasbourg where I can do this. Strasbourg had already become a Protestant city, and that was now his ambition, to be a scholar serving the Lord through his scholarship. But because of war between the Holy Roman Empire, Charles V, and the French King, Francis I, because the armies along the border there were fighting, it was necessary for Calvin to take a detour and to go south to Lyon and then through Geneva and then to come up to Strasbourg. Somebody has called that the divine detour. When Calvin reached Geneva, expecting to spend a night or two and then be on his way, he met a fellow Frenchman, William Farrell. Farrell had been converted to the Protestant faith and had begun reform in the French-speaking area of Switzerland. You might know that at Le Brie in Waymo, the study center is called Farrell House, named for William Farrell, who preached in that area of Switzerland and began the reform there. By 1535, with the support of Bern, which had become Protestant through the preaching of Zwingli and Bullinger, Geneva was led to the Protestant position, and Farrell came in order to preach the gospel and convert people and establish the church. He was a pioneer in worship and in doctrine, but primarily Farrell was a preacher, a hot gospeler, somebody has called him, because he preached fiery sermons. There is a statue of William Farrell in Neuchâtel, which shows him in action with his Bible above his head, preaching away. Have a closer look at that statue and look at the face of Farrell. He's a rather determined man, as depicted in this statue. Well, Calvin arrived. Farrell realized that Calvin was there, knew something about him, and thought, this is just the man I need to stay here and help in this work. Farrell could get things stirred up, but he needed Calvin to teach, consolidate, organize. And he made his proposal, and Calvin said, no, thank you, I'm on the way to Strasbourg to be a scholar. Well, you really could not turn Farrell down that easily. And as Calvin explained it later in the preface to the Psalms commentary, Farrell besought God to curse my retirement and the tranquility of my studies if I should withdraw and refuse to give assistance when the necessity was so urgent. Here is Calvin, shocked by Farrell's insistence that he stay there, and even saying, God will curse what you're going to do if you don't stay here. Now, I'm not recommending that we follow Farrell in that. We can't know God's will for somebody else that clearly, but I think God had a hand in all this. In fact, Calvin says so. He said, I felt as if God from heaven had laid his mighty hand upon me to stop me in my course. Someplace else, Calvin says, God thrust me into the game. And this time it is clear who the human instrument was. It was William Farrell. Calvin and Farrell then had about 2 years in the church in Geneva, preaching, catechizing, organizing, setting up church discipline. But Geneva wasn't quite ready for these two. And in a couple of years, it became obvious that the church in Geneva would much prefer that they leave. In fact, Calvin and Farrell were very much mistreated. Genevans would name their dogs Calvin so they could kick the dogs around. And they would shoot off guns outside his bedroom window at night just to bother him, and throw rocks through the window when they would see him studying. So it was not a good relationship between the pastor and the church there. And pretty soon, the city council said, you must go, and expelled Calvin and Farrell. And Calvin at last got to Strasbourg. I think with a sigh of relief, he left Geneva and went where he wanted to go in the first place. And there he had 3 years, sometimes called the golden years in Calvin's life, because three very wonderful years in the city of Strasbourg. He had a mentor now, a friend. And this young man needed somebody to come alongside of him and say, no, this is how you do it. This is how you really get along with people, and this is how you lead them, and this is how you preach. And William Bucer was a wonderful friend and mentor. I'm sorry, Martin Bucer. He was an Erasmian Dominican, converted through the preaching of Luther in Strasbourg, and he had served in that city from 1523. Much influence comes into Calvin's life from this important mentor and friend, Martin Bucer. And Calvin had a ministry there. Bucer was not going to let Calvin sit around and study either. I mean, there was too much to be done in these days, and there was a congregation of 500 French refugees in Strasbourg, and Calvin became the pastor of that congregation. He preached and counseled almost every day, and he became a beloved minister. He learned how to serve effectively in the church, in a settled rather than a pioneering ministry. So God needed to take him to Strasbourg and let him do an internship with Martin Bucer, and then he's going to have to go back eventually to Geneva. But before he did that, also in Strasbourg, he found a wife, Idalette de Boer, a widow with two children. There is a book called Idalette, a historical novel written by Mrs. John Gerstner, which tells the story of this remarkable woman in the historical novel approach. I'm very fond of that book, and particularly of Mrs. Gerstner's dedication. She dedicates the book to her husband, and it reads this way: to my husband, John Gerstner, a professor of church history, without whose help this book would have been far less accurate, but far more interesting. Well, Calvin and Idalette married. He wrote his friend William Farrell, she is not only good and honorable, but also handsome. And Calvin and Idalette married and had wonderful life, but only 10 short years. A wonderful life because they really did love each other, something similar to Katie and Martin Luther's relationship. Calvin spoke about her as a precious help and an excellent companion. Their only child died within a few days of being born. Yadalad had two children, since she had been married before and was a widow, and those children lived with John and Idalet. But the one child they had died almost at birth, just a few days old. A severe wound, Calvin said, but he comforted himself by saying, God is himself a father, and he knows what's best. Well, Geneva, again, 1541, he was recalled to Geneva. The Genevans by this time realized that they really needed Calvin. And they sent a delegation to ask him to come back. Our textbook, Professor Gonzales, says that he went back without hesitation. Well, that really isn't the way it was. Calvin hesitated and fought against this for quite a while. He wrote to Farrell in 1540, when he knew what was happening, that he would rather submit to death 100 times than to that cross on which he had to perish daily 1,000 times over. But the next year, Calvin wrote to Farrell, but when I remember that I'm not my own, I offer up my heart, presented as a sacrifice to the Lord. That's a wonderful thing that Calvin said, because that brings his motto into action. He now is putting into practice what he had said he wanted to characterize his life, and that is obedient service to God. And so Calvin went in 1541 back to Geneva, a city where he would spend the rest of his life serving as pastor in Church of St. Peter's, a large church on the hill. As we think of the shape of Calvin's ministry the next 23 years, there are several things that I'd like to say about that. You know, he wanted the quiet life of a scholar. He wanted to write books. But God just kept him doing the work of a busy pastor. So we think of Calvin's ministry, certainly, first of all, we have to put preacher and teacher. That's how he saw himself. He identified himself in his will as minister of the Word of God in the Church of Geneva. And so for these 23 years, he preached regularly from the high pulpit in Saint-Pierre to great congregations of people. Calvin preached not only on Sundays, but several other days in the week, too. He usually preached 5 times a week. He preached without notes. We have his sermons because people wrote down what he said. Groups of people, so if one missed one word, another one could get it, perhaps, and they would compare notes and put together Calvin's sermons. So there are many, many sermons, at least 2,000 of Calvin's sermons that were recorded. Calvin preached, of course, in French, and the sermons are written in French. Some have been translated into English, but not all that many of Calvin's sermons have been translated. Calvin was very much concern with what we call expository preaching. That's how he did it. Like Zwingli, preaching through books in the Bible, verse by verse. In fact, the first Sunday that he was back in Geneva in 1541, having been expelled almost 3 years before, the church was crowded like it is in this picture to hear what he was going to say. People were perhaps a little bit ashamed and expected Calvin to let them have it for the way they had treated him before. And the moment was very tense as Calvin stood up to deliver his first sermon back in Geneva. And he said, you remember 3 years ago I was on this verse, today we take it up here. And he went right on to the next verse without any preceding comments. Nothing could have been less dramatic but more effective in illustrating what Calvin saw as very important in ministry. He was not only a preacher and a teacher, he was a reformer. Even more than Luther, Calvin felt that the church, life, personal life, worship, culture, all of human existence must come under the control of God and be reformed by the Word of God. B.B. Warfield puts it well, I think, when he says that Calvin found Protestantism a mob and transformed it into an army. Calvin was active in reform, of course, in the church, and as Calvin created a polity for the church in Geneva and the surrounding area of the city, he brought into existence the basic structure of what we now call Presbyterianism in his ecclesiastical ordinances of the Church of Geneva. Calvin also worked for the independence of the church in spiritual matters. Calvin did not believe in separation of church and state as we do today, but he felt that the church in spiritual matters, particularly in discipline leading up to excommunication, the church and not the state should control that. The preaching of the word and the exercise of discipline and the administration of the sacraments, Calvin believed that the church must be independent of the state. And it took him a long time to convince the city fathers, the councils in Geneva, to agree with that. It was not until 1555 that the power of excommunication was lodged in the consistory rather than in the councils. And then Calvin worked to create a biblical form of worship, a liturgy, in his form of prayers and hymns or psalms. The church in Geneva with Calvin had a very wonderful service of biblical worship and praise to God. Let me talk for a moment about Calvin in his relationship to the state, because people often misunderstand this and I think misrepresent Calvin at this point. Calvin was not, contrary to what you may have heard in university and college, Calvin was not the dictator of Geneva, who was ruling the city with an iron hand. Alistair McGrath writes that Calvin was only granted bourgeois status at Geneva in his old age. He never became a citizen of the city. He could not stand for office, and until 1559 could not even vote in city elections, nor did he have privileged access to or direct influence over the city council at any point during his career. He did have influence in the city, but he did not control the government of the city. The councils were composed of powerful men. Calvin did urge and cajole and plead, but he did not and he could not command. Calvin was not the dictator, and secondly, Geneva was not a theocracy. So many popular books on history will refer to this theocracy in Switzerland, where the Old Testament was brought into play and the city was governed according to the Mosaic law. It's not true. There was, of course, close connection between church and state, but the laws of Geneva were not Old Testament civil laws. Geneva was not a theocracy, and Calvin was not a theonomist. Calvin taught that the principles of love and justice exemplified in the laws of the Old Testament, but not the laws themselves were to be carried out in the life of the modern state. Heresy in Geneva, as well as everywhere else in 16th century Europe, was not only considered blasphemy against God, but a civil crime. So people were put to death for heretical views in the 16th century, and of course we all know that with Servetus that happened in Geneva. Servetus was burned in 1553 for blasphemies against the Holy Trinity. It wasn't true that people were constantly being put to death in Geneva. Very few people were executed for heresy in Geneva, perhaps only two. But still, two were executed. And Calvin was involved, although McGrath says his role was somewhat peripheral. This was not a time when he was really in great favor with the councils, and they carried out this decision apart from Calvin, but he did not oppose it, and Servetus was put to death. One of Calvin's opponents, another Protestant who at one time had been a Calvinist but became something else, Castellio, wrote a book called Concerning Heretics, Whether They Ought to Be Persecuted. And Castellio said, to kill a man is not to destroy a heresy. It's just to kill a man. But Calvin had not advanced to that point, nor had Geneva. And it's going to take many more deaths and many more years before there will be anything that will approximate the writings of Castellio. 1559 It was a great year in Geneva, and we'll see next time that the final definitive edition of Calvin's Institutes came out in that year. There was no monument to Calvin in Geneva until the early part of the 20th century. On the 400th anniversary of his birth, reformed people around the world gave money to erect what is called the Reformation Wall in Geneva, and that is part of a lovely park with other statues as well, depicting scenes in Reformed church history in different countries, but it shows this group of men on the Reformation Wall depicted in this statue, or these statues, shows the four men, four of the leaders of the church who were together in Geneva in the year 1559. There is the depiction of Farel and then Calvin, Beza, who was Calvin's successor and the leader of the Academy, which became the University of Geneva, and then John Knox, three Frenchmen and a Scot, on this Reformation Wall, depicting their activity together in Geneva in 1559. Calvin died just 5 years later. He was 55 years old. He asked that there be no monument or marker of his tomb, so I'm not sure what he would have thought or about this huge 15-foot statue of him now in Geneva, but he was buried in the common cemetery in the town. The minutes of the little council, a council that he had often fought with, those minutes record this line: God gave him a character of great majesty, and his friend and successor in the church and the academy in Geneva, Theodore Beza, wrote, "Now that Calvin is dead, life will be less sweet and death less bitter." Therefore, seeing that we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us. Okay, a few minutes for questions today. Yes, the question is, was Calvin sick most of his life, and what kind of illness did he have? Calvin was often sick. The problem with trying to think of what people had in those days is difficult, even for doctors today, to determine, because symptoms were described in various ways that don't always correspond to our modern understanding of medicine and illness. But there are some rather terrifying descriptions of Calvin's illness from himself in his letters. He would write at great length about some of the things that he felt happening to him. We know he suffered greatly from migraine headaches, but he seemed to have a lot of things wrong with him. And you know, just before he died, he was propped up on pillows in his bed, still writing, still working on a commentary. He was working on Ezekiel. He had written commentaries on most of the Bible, but he had not finished Ezekiel. And he was about halfway through Ezekiel when an unfinished sentence indicated that that was as far as Calvin was able to go. But as he was writing away, his friend said, "You know, you don't have to do this. You've done plenty. Why don't you just rest?" And Calvin said, "Would you have the Lord come and find me idle?" So he was not a man to, you know, to take much time off. Although John Knox, the Scot, was rather startled to find Calvin bowling on Sunday. I don't know if it was because it was Sunday or because Calvin was bowling. Other questions? Yes. Okay, how did Calvin struggle with the execution of Servetus? Calvin and the church in Geneva wrote other churches saying, "What would you do?" Now, Servetus had been condemned by the Catholics, and they were careless enough to let him get away. So he came to Geneva. He was a strange man. You know, he was a brilliant doctor, but a very erratic genius. And he came to Geneva thinking that he would confront Calvin in his own city and perhaps convert Calvin to his Unitarian faith. So the scene was set for the tragedy. Calvin struggled with it by trying to find out what the other churches would do, the Lutherans, and everybody said he deserves to die. And he struggled with it further in hoping that he could influence the city council to use some other form of execution rather than burning. We know that Calvin was on record saying, "Don't burn him." That was the cruelest possible way. And Calvin opposed that. But when all is said and done, he said, "Yes, this is right. This must be done." And I don't think we can exonerate Calvin fully from that. There is a statue somewhere in Geneva. I have not seen it, but a marker to Servetus put there by Calvinists. It's a kind of act of concern for this action that was taken. Yes. Comment is a lot of concern, but no repentance. What would you suggest that we do? Yeah, I think that's right. We should say it's wrong. Although I think we should understand the context. You know, it's not like Calvin suddenly appeared today in America and wanted to do this. So even when we say it's wrong, we need to say this is the situation and this is why they did it, but it's still wrong. I think in studying history, one thing we need to do is be as sympathetic as we can to the setting, but still reserve judgment from our point of view today as to whether it's right or wrong. You know, I say that because someday I want people to do that for us. They're going to look back and say, boy, those people in the late 20th century, they did a lot of bad things. Yes. Question relates to Calvin's relationship to the arts. I think you're right. He's between Luther and the radicals. The radicals destroy things pretty easily. Luther doesn't do much of that. He wants to preserve almost everything. There's not a lot of iconoclasm in Geneva. Some things are taken down. Some art was given, paid for by Catholic donors who were then converted to Protestantism and took it back. So it was not so much the destruction of art, but the slow change of attitude toward religious art in church. Now, Calvin was not opposed to theater and art in culture. And in church, he did have music, wonderful psalm tunes written by Louis Bourgeois, the Calvinist. The Calvinist writer of tunes. So music is important, and you can read the Institutes and see how much Calvin loves and appreciates the arts. You know, it's too bad that some of those treasures, those art treasures, and much of that was religious and often in the churches, it's too bad that people in that time could not have said, well, let's just take these things out and put them in a warehouse and leave them for 100 years. But that's asking too much. Okay. Yes, one more question, then we'll go. She died in 1549. They were married 9 years. You know, as I said, Calvin is a very, in a way, introverted person. He doesn't just come out with it like Luther. We have to kind of struggle to get him to express himself. And I don't know if that's, you know, his French background, his aristocratic training, or just his personality, but it's hard to get the emotion of Calvin's own heart to read that in his sermons. The place, though, to find it is in his letters, and you can find some real Calvin, the humanist of John Calvin comes out there. Let me just tell you one short story about this, and we'll go. Pierre is from Lausanne and went to school there. The reformer in Lausanne was Pierre Verret, and he was a friend of Calvin's. Calvin in Geneva, Pierre Verret in Lausanne. And one day Calvin wanted to send a message to Verret, and the way to do that would be to ask a couple of the students at the academy in Geneva to take it. So Calvin wrote the message. The two students were standing there. And Calvin finished his message, sealed it up, gave it to one of the students for them to go to Lausanne. But then he said, no, wait a minute. And he sat down and wrote a second letter. When Verret got the two letters, he read the first letter, which had to do with the business that Calvin wanted to transact. But the second letter said, Dear Pierre, I don't have anything to add to what I wrote in that first letter. But when I saw that this other student was disappointed, that he did not have a letter to carry to Lausanne, I thought I would write another one. And please act very surprised when you read this. So that's the humanist of John Calvin. There's a book called The Humanist of John Calvin. There's no such book called The Humanist of Martin Luther, because everybody knows that he's human. Okay, thank you.